Before we get into today's episode, we want to tell you about another show from the team behind The Final Hours, Hidden History with Dr. Harini Bhatt.
Every Monday, Dr. Bhatt goes where history gets uncomfortable. Vanished civilizations, doomsday prophecies, paranormal phenomena, and events that science still can't fully explain.
She'll give you historical context, break down the science, and even interrogate the supernatural, and ask, what if it happened today?
Hidden History drops every Monday. Follow now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss a mystery.
This is Crime House.
It's Monday, December 14th, 1981. In St. John's, the capital of Newfoundland, Canada, winter has officially taken hold. The days are shorter, and by late afternoon, the light is already starting to fade. By 5:20 p.m., it's already pitch dark out. Headlights pass along Topsail Road, a busy route in and out of the city. In a vacant lot across from a McDonald's, brothers Harry and John Smeaton are selling Christmas trees. It's gotten cold enough that they've spent most of the day sitting in their truck, waiting for customers who are probably never coming. So to pass the time, they watch the road, commenting on the people going by. And that's when they notice a young woman, or maybe a teenage girl. From this far, it's hard to tell.
She's standing at a bus stop, and at first it seems like she's waiting. But then she sticks out her thumb. Now it's clear to the brothers that she's hitchhiking. Harry and John shake their heads. They know it's a trend with teenagers at the moment, but hitchhiking feels dangerous to them. So they get nervous as they watch a car pull up. The girl walks over and tries the passenger door, but it doesn't open. The driver has to lean across and open it from the inside. She gets in and they drive off. The brothers hope the driver was just a good Samaritan, but something about the interaction sticks in their minds long after the fact. Which will be a big help later, because the Smeatons have just witnessed the last confirmed sighting of 14-year-old Dana Bradley. And what they saw will shape the investigation into her murder. Every year, over 500,000 people go missing, and that's just in the United States alone. Most of those stories barely get a headline. Some don't even get a flyer or a tip line. And when cases do get media attention, we usually only get the broad strokes.
But for those of us who have lived these true crime cases, we know the devil's in the details. This is The Final Hours, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. I'm Sarah Turney.
And I'm Courtney Nicole. Every Monday, Sarah and I will be looking at the final hours of someone's disappearance, the small, seemingly mundane moments to see if there was anything hiding in plain sight.
Looking back at all those last conversations, connections, and choices is critical, and it could be the key to unlocking it all. Each episode, I'll offer insight on what those close to the victim might have been going through, and Courtney will use her expertise to give more context into the crime scene, the red flags, and the investigation itself. And we want to thank you for being a part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow the show. And for ad-free access to every episode, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts.
This episode, we're discussing the case of 14-year-old Dana Bradley. In December 1981, Dana spent the afternoon at a friend's house before hitching a ride to her mom's birthday dinner. She'd hitchhiked plenty of times before, but unfortunately, this would be her last. Dana never made it to that dinner, and what should have been a celebratory night turned into one that still haunts the Bradleys and St. John's, Canada, today.
It's December 1981. Dana Bradley is 14 years old and living with her mom and grandmother in St. John's, the capital of Newfoundland, Canada. Newfoundland is a large, beautiful island off the East Coast, known for being Canada's happiest province. And if you ask Dana, she'd probably agree. She's in the ninth grade, her final year at I.J. Sampson Junior High School. By most accounts, she's enjoying life. Not only is Dana a good student, but she's also extremely artistic. One of her teachers, Glenda Cluett, even allowed her to paint a mural on the back wall of her classroom, and Dana's been working really hard at it. She often spends her lunch period or her free time after school painting on her own. And she's dedicated, not the type to commit to something and back out. A great example of this was a story I heard about Dana from when she was in the seventh grade. She tried to get in the Guinness Book of World Records for holding a smile for the longest time. Classmates remember her smiling all day long, to the point where she got a severe earache and was forced to stop. Even though she didn't break the world record, she was featured in the local paper for trying. Dana's always done well socially, too. She's known for being popular without being snobby. She has friends across different grades, and she's always put together. Her outfits are noticeable. She puts a lot of effort into how she looks. That being said, like most 14-year-olds, Dana's gotten a bit rebellious lately. She recently threw a big party at her house when her mom was out of town. And this year, she's played hooky from a couple days of school. Plus, as we mentioned, Dana and her friends have gotten into hitchhiking lately.
Yeah, back in the 80s, hitchhiking was like this new and really exciting thing to do, especially for teenagers. I mean, a lot of people, like a lot of young kids even hitchhiked, like even to the mall. Like, it was kind of compared to when smoking was like up and coming. It was like this new cool thing to do.
Yeah, and from looking at the area and researching this case, it was a really popular thing to do in this particular area. It's hard. Obviously, I think that everybody who hitchhikes, and when you hear about hitchhiking, you know about the dangers. But when you're young and you're carefree and all your friends are doing it, I get why.
Yeah, especially like St. John's was a really like safe and small town. So I feel like most people, and especially like younger kids like Dana, they probably just didn't think of like how serious this could end up. Like, of course, now looking at it from, you know, 2026, like we know of the dangers that could come with it. And I feel like it's something that we don't see very often anymore just because of like the bad outcomes. But kind of like a fun fact, I guess I would say, did you know that hitchhiking is actually illegal in 6 U.S. states?
I didn't know that, but I mean, honestly, it should be at this point, just for people's protection. Did you ever hitchhike? Like, I was always too scared.
Yeah, I never have hitchhiked, and I never will hitchhike, just because, obviously, I listen to a lot of true crime, and so I'm normally very paranoid, so that is something I will never do, and I will never suggest anybody to go and hitchhike, just because you genuinely never know who the person hitchhiking is or who the driver could be. Like, you just never know.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad, right? I wish that we could live in a society where it was safe, but the cold, harsh reality is it's just not.
Look, Dana may have been in a bit of a wild phase, but that's all it seemed to be, a phase. Honestly, it sounded like she wasn't very good at being bad. If she tried anything, she usually got caught. Her mom, Dawn, threw a fit when she discovered Dana had thrown that party without her permission, and her teachers always reprimanded her for ditching school. Actually, scolding Dana is the last thing Mrs. Kluwer remembers doing the day Dana disappeared.
Yeah, so on Monday, December 14th, 1981, she catches Dana red-handed forging a note from her mother, explaining away one of Dana's many unexcused absences. Mrs. Kluwer talks to her about it, and Dana apparently leaves the classroom in tears. But after school, Dana pulls herself together. She and her friends Terry and Penny hitch a ride from a stranger to a spot close to Terry's house. Terry and Dana had grown up together, but they recently became friends with Penny. The three girls hang out at Terry's for a bit. Then Dana and Penny leave and walk over to Penny's. Penny and her boyfriend had just broken up, and Dana wants to give him a call and talk to him about it. It's not clear if she's trying to play matchmaker and get them back together, or if she feels like telling him off. Whatever her reason, Dana's there to support Penny, so she stays at Penny's house for a couple more hours. But she has a hard out at 5 p.m. It's her mom's birthday dinner that night. Dana and her mom, Dawn, are incredibly close. In fact, a lot of people said that they were best friends. Dana's an only child, and her dad isn't in the picture, so they rely on each other a lot. And even in the midst of Dana's rebellious phase, their bond stays strong.
I feel like only children, they're kind of known for being a lot more like independent than, you know, when you have kids come from like a big family with a lot of siblings.
Yeah, I could see that. Like, I'm one of six, but after 12, I was basically the only one left in the house. So I feel like I was raised kind of in both environments as one of six and an only child. And yeah, I mean, they do have a lot of independence, and you tend to get pretty close with that parent, especially a single parent household like I came from, you know. And it's hard because I can see the argument for being too close, and also the argument for being close to your child and developing this relationship with them, fostering this trust and honesty, which from a teenager, I think is something you want.
Yeah, I feel like having that sort of like independency, it could be a really good thing, but it could also be a really bad thing. In Dana's case, it kind of leads to her wanting to do more things by herself, which, as we know, kind of is what's getting her into like hitchhiking. She probably doesn't want to, you know, bother her mom too much, especially being a single mom. Now, unfortunately, as we know, the outcome of the story and Dana, you know, disappears. I kind of have to put myself in her mom's shoes. Like, I feel like losing a child at any point is really, really hard. But then when it comes to being like an only child, like that is like your entire world just gone. Like that has to be really, really hard to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're so close with, right? It's just so, so hard. But I have to hope, you know, that in their relationship and being so close, that Dana was able to go to her mom and navigate some of those situations in a different way if she wasn't, you know, able to go to her parent. I think that there's just so much value in being close and open and honest with a teenager when they're going through, especially a rebellious phase like Dana.
Well, around 5 p.m., Dana calls her grandparents from Penny's house, maybe to see if she could get a ride home, but no one answered. Then she tried to call her mom at the salon she owned and worked at. Again, no answer. Finally, she calls her house, and eventually her mom's fiancé, Jeff Levitz, answers. She asks him for a ride, but he says he's busy and asks her if she can just take the bus. Dana only lives about a 10-minute drive away, but it will be a bit of a walk to the bus stop. She pulls on her favorite ski jacket with navy stripes on the sleeves. Underneath, she's wearing a blue sweater, jeans, and cowboy boots. School books tucked under her arm, Dana leaves Penny's house, which is situated on a cul-de-sac. She tells her she'll call her as soon as she makes it home safe. Eventually, she turns off the residential street and begins walking down Topsail Road, which at that time was one of the main ways in and out of downtown St. John's. There were shops, restaurants, a mall, and new housing going up. It was a pretty busy area. Dana positions herself across the road from a couple of popular businesses, a McDonald's and a Tim Hortons coffee shop, both of which are full of customers at that time. But after waiting for the bus for a few minutes, Dana gets impatient. Instead, she sticks out her thumb and waits for someone to pull over. She has no idea this will be the last ride she ever takes.
It's December 14th, 1981, a little after 5 p.m. 14-year-old Dana Bradley stands on the side of Topsail Road, a busy street in St. John's, Newfoundland, with her thumb out. She's trying to hitch a ride home. Before leaving her friend Penny's house, Dana called home and tried to get a ride. Her mom's fiancé, Jeff Levitz, answered and asked if she could take the bus. And Dana didn't argue. But after waiting a few minutes at the stop, she decided to hitchhike instead. By 8:30 p.m., after 3.5 hours pass without any sign of Dana, her mom, Dawn, is starting to panic. She calls both Penny and Terry, wondering if Dana got distracted and lost track of time. But neither of the girls have seen Dana since she left Penny's. Dawn considers other options. If Dana wasn't at a friend's house, she was often at the Village Mall hanging out with classmates. So she grabs a photo of her daughter and heads over there. She shows Dana's picture to everyone she can, asking if anyone has seen her, but she has no luck. By this point, Dawn's positive something's wrong. Next, Jeff and Dawn hop into his car and set off. They drive around St. John's looking for any sign of Dana. A rogue school book, her jacket, something that says she made it close to home. When Dawn and Jeff don't find anything, they go down to the police station.
Unfortunately, officers in the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary aren't immediately concerned about Dana since she'd only been gone for a few hours. Officers try to tell Jeff that they need to wait 24 hours before filing a missing persons report. But just like in the US, there isn't actually a law in Canada that makes that true. Whether Jeff knew that or he and Dawn just pushed back enough is unclear. But they get the police to file the report that night.
Why are we always making this a fight to report children missing?
I don't know. I see it again and again. And I feel like I struggle with kind of like standing up for myself and like putting my foot down even now, 27 years old, grown adult, in my like regular day-to-day life. But for some reason, I feel like it's even harder when you're like faced with like this, with these authority figures, like the police. I feel like it's even harder for me to like stand up. So it's like refreshing to hear that Dawn and Jeff like really put their foot down and like made them take this seriously right off the bat.
Yeah, well, I think fear will do that to you, right? Like I'm the type of person, like if my food comes out from a restaurant and it's bad, like I'm just gonna eat it. I'm not gonna say anything, right? Like that's the level of, you know, avoiding conflict that I live in. But when it comes to the police and working with them for so many years now, I can stand up to them pretty easily, which I think just, it's kind of like priority and importance, right? When that adrenaline is pumping through you, when you're fighting for your loved one, when you're trying to report your kid missing, you know, I think that helps in these situations. So even like the most meek people possibly like me, you know, when that's all pumping through your veins, it kind of changes you.
Yeah, especially when you know, like, without a doubt, your loved one would not just up and, like, run away or get distracted and not, you know, notify their family. But I feel like I've seen this time and time again where, especially back then in the 80s, police kind of, like, dismiss teenagers, like, disappearances because they think that they just kind of ran away or, like, out partying, having fun. And I feel like, as we all know, like, those first few hours of somebody's disappearance, it's so critical to kind of, like, take charge right away.
Exactly. I mean, how many times are we going to talk about a case where a kid goes missing and the police say they're probably just out having fun with their friends, you know, and then this child never comes back? Like, how many times is that going to happen before these police, you know, department stations, whoever makes these policies, right, is going to say, we have to change something here. What we're doing is clearly not working.
It's infuriating because, like, obviously you don't want to assume the worst, but when you have, like, these parents of these young kids coming to you and saying, like, this is not like her, like, this is completely out of character, it's better just be safe than sorry.
Yeah. And we talk about the stats, right? The stats say that most kids are going to come back, but at what point do we cater to that 1% or whatever it is that doesn't? Like, which party should we be catering to? All these children that surely come back or the ones who don't? You know, obviously, I think that we need to start catering to the kids who don't come back. Well, the next day doesn't amount to much, but on Wednesday, December 16th, 2 days after she'd gone missing, Dana's picture hits the local newspapers alongside pleas for any information about her disappearance. When a man named Harry Smeaton sees Dana's photo, he immediately picks up the phone to call his brother John. 2 days earlier, Harry and John had been selling Christmas trees out of an empty lot on Topsail Road, right across from McDonald's. They were positive they'd seen Dana hitchhiking outside the bus stop. But by the time Harry reaches his brother, John has beaten him to the punch. He'd seen the story earlier and already called the police.
Their tip goes like this. At around 5:20 p.m. on the evening of the 14th, Harry and John saw a sedan pull over for Dana. They watched as Dana attempted to open the passenger side door, but struggled. The driver leaned over and opened the door from the inside. Dana got in and the car drove away. Even though the Smeaton brothers both reached out to the authorities on the 16th, their calls weren't returned for days. At that time, the police were working methodically through the hundreds of tips they'd received. Plus, they were organizing search parties made up of local volunteers. Had they called the Smeatons back right away, authorities may have been able to narrow their focus, specifically to cars matching their description. Unfortunately, they didn't get to this crucial information in time, and 4 days after she disappeared, it was clear they were too late.
On December 18th, 1981, a couple named Helen and Dale Smith put their children in the car and went in search of a Christmas tree to cut down. At about 2:30 p.m., they drive south out of St. John's and then head east toward the Atlantic Ocean. As they travel, the woods lining the hills become denser, and soon the perfect trees start appearing. After about 20 minutes, Dale turns onto a street called Maddox Cove Road and parks along a wooded trail. He and his family climb out of the car and begin walking in search of the ideal tree. Dale's wife and children are trailing behind him as they hike, which is a good thing, because that means Dale's alone when he stumbles upon a horrific sight.
At first, Dale thinks he's looking at a discarded mannequin. The body is female, wearing school clothes and lying on her back. Her books are tucked under one of her arms, but Dale runs back to his family before getting a good look at her face. He whispers what he found to Helen, who takes off to go have a look for herself. When Helen sees the body, she recognizes it immediately. It's the missing girl they'd seen in the papers, Dana Bradley. Keeping their children away from the scene, the Smiths find a nearby woodcutter and direct him toward the body. They ask him to keep watch while they drive home to call 911. Dawn happens to be at the station when police receive the call. She can't hear what's being said on the other end of the line, but she knows it's something serious when the officers begin clearing out. No one tells her specifically in that moment, but Dawn has a hunch this has to do with Dana.
And in that moment, no one's coming between Dawn and the truth. She hops in her car and follows the police as far as she can, before she loses them at a red light. Then she goes home, she and Jeff get back in the car and drive in the same direction, until eventually they find the crime scene.
30 minutes after finding Dana's body, the police have the scene cordoned off. The area is technically outside the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary's jurisdiction. So by the time Dawn and Jeff get there, the investigation's been handed over from the RNC to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. At first, the officers at the scene won't reveal anything about what they found, not even to Dawn. But eventually, someone lets her know they have, in fact, found the body of a girl, though they won't say who.
Dawn and Jeff are told to go home and wait for more information. But deep down, they already know what would be confirmed to them later that day. It was Dana's body at the crime scene. She's been murdered.
While investigators continue to comb through the woods, officers at the police station start frantically returning tip calls, which means that finally, someone calls the Smeaton brothers back. One of the things that stands out is how Dana struggled to get into the passenger side of a light-colored sedan with rust along the bottom frame. Authorities quickly realize that their story matches that of a truck driver, someone who'd driven down Topsail Road that night and saw Dana walk up to the passenger side of a pale sedan. The police also speak to another set of witnesses who'd called in about a strange sighting later that night on December 14th. At about 11:30 p.m., the couple claimed they were driving north along Maddox Cove Road near where Dana's body had been found and spotted a car pulled over on the shoulder. It appeared to be empty, but the passenger door was open and the dome light was on. As they passed, they saw a lone man standing nearby, about 10 to 15 feet away. After that, the Smeatons were interviewed several times to get more details on the sedan. The brothers went back and forth, but eventually narrowed it down to either a Dodge Dart or a Plymouth Valiant in light yellow or pale green. But the time of day and overhead streetlights made it hard to determine the exact shade.
The Smeaton brothers also described what they could see of the driver. They believed he was a Caucasian male in his mid-20s. He was clean-shaven, average weight, and had medium-length, messy, light brown hair. They did not see anyone else in the sedan before Dana got in. Both the description of the driver and his car were honestly pretty general. There were thousands of light-colored sedans registered in St. John's alone, and even more 20-something young men with unkempt brown hair. So while officers check through vehicle records and interview owners, investigators turn their attention to the autopsy report to try to learn more.
The autopsies performed the day after Dana's body was discovered, on Saturday, December 19th. Based on skull fractures, it's determined that she'd been killed by blunt force trauma to the head. Her death probably took place on the day she was kidnapped, and it would have been almost instantaneous. Authorities also revealed Dana was a victim of sexual assault, and they find a small amount of foreign scalp and pubic hair on her body. Back in 1981, DNA testing's in its infancy, and the RCMP doesn't have the capability to test the hair found at the crime scene, so they continue searching for more evidence. In the wooded area where Dana's body was found, investigators find no signs of a struggle. Based on that, they think the murder might have taken place elsewhere, and the killer brought Dana's body to a remote location to get rid of it. And because of the way Dana's body was carefully positioned, they think the killer expected her to be found. Some RCMP officers even think that's a sign the killer had grown attached to Dana and felt remorseful. I feel like the thing about remorse is that it's kind of like tied to empathy. Like, you have to be an empathetic person to feel remorse. And I feel like oftentimes, like, these offenders who commit these horrible crimes, I feel like are just incapable of feeling remorse. Like, yeah, maybe there's a small percentage that do, but overall, I feel like they just don't feel remorse. I don't know, you did the bad thing. Like, why did you do it in the first place?
Yeah, so like I'm always one to take, you know, law enforcement's opinion into consideration, but I personally lack empathy for murderers. I just do. I lack the empathy to believe that they feel that type of remorse. And it might be really cold to say that, right? But at a certain point, when you commit such an atrocious crime, especially against a child, my empathy for that person just leaves my body.
One thing I kind of wanted to mention, though, from my own family's experience, if you didn't know, my grandma actually, she killed somebody. It wasn't just anybody. It was like her own mom in a pretty violent way. And if you were to like ask her about it, even today, there are certain parts that she says she blacked out and, you know, didn't remember and can't even like recall. But if you ask her about if she feels remorse or if she regrets it today, she would say yes. So I feel like that's like an interesting and like tricky topic for me, because I have somebody like so close to me in my family that says that they do regret doing like this horrible act. But then when I read stories like Dana's, it's like I'm completely taken out from that personal experience. And I'm like, no, if you like harm a child like this, I don't have empathy for you.
Yeah, no, I get that. I totally understand how you can feel both ways about it, right? And I do think that the crimes are very different. You know, in your family's case, I don't want to speak for your family or for you, right? But, you know, it seemed like this buildup, unfortunately, of abuse that led to that versus this person randomly picking up Dana and, you know, killing and sexually assaulting her. And I always think that there's like chance for reform for these people. But in terms of like feeling empathy for their remorse, I just can't bring myself to do it. And maybe that makes me a bad person. Maybe that makes me mean. I don't know, but that's just truly how I feel. Well, finally, on Monday, December 21st, 1981, 1 week after her disappearance, Dana Bradley's body is laid to rest. Her school closes at noon for any classmates who want to attend her funeral, and the service is packed, showing not only how beloved Dana was within her community, but how hard her death hit everyone. That year, Christmas feels different to the people of St. John's. The typical warm, cozy, festive holiday is overshadowed by a dark cloud. Children sit under the watchful eye of their parents, who worry about letting them out of their sight. Meanwhile, investigators spend less time with their families, choosing instead to work on the case.
Between December 20th and December 31st, over 800 vehicles are tracked down and investigated by the RCMP. Nearly 250 persons of interest are interviewed. And as the world rings in the new year, the people of St. John's are left without much to celebrate. Dana Bradley's case starts to stall that January, and it would stay that way for 4 more years. Until someone finally decides to confess.
It's January of 1986, a little over 4 years after Dana Bradley's disappearance and murder. That month, the police are finally presented with a break in the still open case, a handwritten note. It was written on lined paper, and the author claimed they knew who was responsible for Dana's murder, a 35-year-old man named David Summerton.
Investigators have spent years with hardly any solid leads, so they take this one very seriously. Teams start looking into the claim and whether or not the note is legit. They start by examining the paper itself. Using forensic techniques, they're able to lift faint impressions that were left behind on the page, and they find numbers that were written on the sheet above it. Those numbers turn out to be a prescription. When police follow up with the Pharmaceutical Association, they trace the prescriptions back to a specific drugstore, and they identify who they've been issued to and what they were for. The prescriptions are, in fact, under the name David Summerton. At that stage, police still don't know who wrote the note, but when they go to David's house, they find a pad of paper that matches it. By examining the pages left behind, they're also able to recover parts of the original message. After consulting handwriting experts, it's very clear David had written that note himself. On January 13th, 1986, David's arrested on suspicion of murder and brought to the station for questioning. During his interrogation, he admits to writing the note, and he confesses to murdering Dana.
David says he killed Dana with a blackjack, which is a lead weight weapon, sort of like a police club. He then admits to burying the blackjack along Maddox Cove Road, near where Dana's body was found. As for his car, David said he left it at the dump years ago. Still, investigators are certain they found their man, especially because some of the information he shares had never been released to the public. What that exactly is remains a mystery.
I always feel like torn when I read in these cases there have been like written confessions, because I feel like I've seen enough of these cases where they turn out to be hoaxes, or where like they only offer information that is easily available to the public. In this case, though, there is information in the note where it's just never been revealed to the public. So I feel like I'm just torn.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Whenever I hear about a confession in a case, you know, it always makes me skeptical. But when law enforcement says that they have information that's never been released to the public, you know, it changes things.
It definitely gets my attention. I don't know. I feel like why people choose to confess, I mean, it could be so many different reasons. I don't know. I feel like it could be like the weight of the guilt, fear of being caught, or simply just like wanting attention after not getting any for the past, you know, however long since it's been since they committed the crime.
Yeah, well, and especially in a case like this, right, where he writes a note. It's not like he was dragged in and made this confession, right? He writes the note, he confesses, and then they start investigating. It's so hard in cases like this with these confessions and why people do it, why people don't confess, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I feel like, especially in Dana's case, like years had gone by and there's just no movement, like no clue or any indication, like who could have done that and like why. I kind of feel like it could be like, I don't know, his way of confessing. It's kind of like a need to regain control of the crime or like the situation.
Yeah, it certainly could be, right? Or like reliving that thrill. We've seen that, you know, in solved cases all the time where the killer gets caught because they like can't give up that idea of the thrill. They reach back out to police. They leave another clue. They show up at the crime scene, whatever it might be. They're always trying to like catch that high of murdering somebody. On January 13th, 1986, David's charged with first-degree murder. When the story hits the papers, so do tales of David's eccentricities. Neighbors say he's extremely quiet and rarely engages in conversation. He doesn't even own a telephone. It's also revealed that David grew up in foster care and had recently been suffering from marital issues. He was undergoing counseling to cope. With this in his mind, at his second court appearance, David sent to Waterford Hospital for a 30-day psychiatric assessment. The goal is to determine if he was mentally fit to stand trial.
This move not only gives David's defense time to prepare for a possible trial, it also gives the police and the prosecution the opportunity to look for more physical evidence. By mid-February 1986, David is declared fit to stand trial. He's denied bail, and the RCMP teams are still searching the areas along Maddox Cove Road for the murder weapon. They're also looking for the car he left at the dump. But at some point during their search, David does something unexpected. He recants his confession. With no car and no murder weapon, investigators begin to doubt whether they'll have enough to secure a conviction, especially if David's now insisting he did not do it.
David claimed he'd been pressured into confessing after being questioned for hours by the RCMP. He also said he was undergoing withdrawal from heavy alcohol and drug use at the time, which made it hard to get through what was already a difficult and lengthy interrogation. He blamed his addiction for writing the note as well, and his lawyer agreed that David didn't know what he was doing when he wrote it.
So instead of going to trial and risking an acquittal, the prosecution puts the charge on hold and keeps investigating. Roughly 4 months later, though, they drop the murder charges against David entirely, and instead, they charge him with obstruction of justice. By this point, the RCMP has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and several months searching for evidence that did not exist. So David is convicted and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Still, Canadian authorities are determined to solve the case. Over the next few years, it's continually featured in newspapers and TV programs. Multiple rewards are offered for information, and countless suspects are interrogated. Then, in 2000, a new opportunity presents itself.
Almost 20 years after Dana's murder, the technology to test mitochondrial DNA becomes available. The hairs found at Dana's crime scene did not have roots, which made traditional DNA testing somewhat useless. But this new technology allows the entire hair to get tested. Authorities compare the DNA samples to those from any previous suspects or other criminals who were active in the area at the time. Unfortunately, they don't get any matches. Once again, the Dana Bradley case goes cold. It'll be another 11 years before it makes headlines again. And this time, it's because someone claims to have actually witnessed the crime.
On December 14, 2011, the 30th anniversary of Dana Bradley's murder, a 36-year-old man named Danny Tough comes forward, and he has a story he's been holding on to for decades. Danny says that on the night of December 14, 1981, his parents left him in the care of their neighbor-slash-next-door neighbor named Thomas Carey for a few days. Thomas offered to take 6-year-old Danny and another boy to McDonald's on Topsail Road for an early dinner. And he borrowed Danny's father's car, a light-colored two-door Dodge Dart. As they were leaving the McDonald's parking lot, Thomas noticed Dana trying to get a ride across the street. He pulled over and Dana tried to get in the car, but Danny remembers her having trouble. He explained to Thomas that the door was broken. It had to be opened from inside the car. Danny told him how to do it. Danny said Dana seemed more comfortable getting into the car when she saw that there were children inside. The boys were small for their age, so from outside, no one could see them there. Once Dana got in, she turned around and talked to them. Danny remembered her asking their names and what grade they were in. Danny said the drive from Topsail Road to what he later learned was Dana's street seemed normal at first. Dana pointed out her house and told Thomas to slow down, but he didn't. He kept driving. That's when the panic set in. Dana repeatedly asked Thomas to stop the car. Danny recalled her even trying to jump out as they went up the hills. Each time, Thomas grabbed her and sped up. Eventually, he pulled off into some kind of pit. Inside the car, Thomas kept saying he just wanted a kiss. But Dana was crying and fighting him off from the passenger seat. Then she scratched his face, giving her a chance to get out of the car and run. Thomas then got out and chased her. After a few minutes, Danny got out of the car too. By then, Thomas had caught Dana, and they were fighting on the ground. Danny stood near the car as the murder took place and could even see the weapon, a tire iron, from the car. He also believes he witnessed Dana get sexually assaulted. He remembered crying, but feeling unable to stop what he was seeing without putting himself in danger. When Thomas was finished with Dana, he put her body in the trunk and they drove off. Along the way, he pulled over and got out to dispose of the tire iron.
When they reached the Maddox Cove Road area, Thomas pulled Dana's body out of the trunk, tied booster cables around her, and dragged her into the bushes. Once again, Danny got out of the car. But this time, he followed Thomas. When he saw Dana lying in the brush, he grew hysterical and refused to leave her side. Thomas told Danny that Dana's parents would be looking for her, and that she would be going to school the next morning. Danny said that if that was the case, then Dana would need her books. So Thomas went back to the car, retrieved them, and placed them under her arm. Then he grabbed Danny and took him back into the car. He dropped the boys back off at their parents. Afterwards, Danny thought that would be the end of it. He was wrong.
Later that night, Danny said that Thomas woke him up and told him to get dressed. They drove back to the site where Thomas was planning to search for his booster cables. Looking back, Danny thinks Thomas brought him along as cover, so if they were seen, he could say that he was taking the child to his parents. When they stopped along Maddox Cove Road, Danny waited in the car, but eventually grew scared in the dark, so he got out. This turned the dome light on, which is when Danny remembers seeing another car drive by. Danny believed the people in that car may have had their windows down long enough to notice them, but after a moment, they drove off. When Thomas returned, Danny said that he had the booster cables with him, but he also had some of Dana's hair, which he showed off proudly. After that, they drove back to Thomas's house, where he made Danny help him clean the trunk of the car. When he was finished, he forced Danny into the car and sexually assaulted him. Then he threatened him with death if he ever told anyone about that day.
Danny never told anyone this. He claims he had suppressed the memory through alcohol. He started drinking at a young age, and when he finally stopped in his early 30s, it all came rushing back. He told his parents, who were mortified, and in 2011 he told the police, who were interested but skeptical. And what's maybe the most shocking part is that sources like the Twin City News say that Thomas was a former mayor of Witless Bay and a former liberal candidate in the 1989 provincial election. But in 1991, he was convicted on a few charges of sexual assault.
Elements of Danny's story align perfectly with other witness accounts, the passenger side door having to be opened from the inside, and the parked car on Maddox Cove Road with its dome light on. The car itself, however, was an issue. The Smeatons were fairly sure they'd seen a four-door sedan, not a two-door like Danny's father's Dodge Dart. And even though it didn't perfectly match their description, police had already searched Danny's father's car back in 1981 during a sweep of all the vehicles in the area that fit the description, and they found nothing. Despite their skepticism, authorities investigated Danny's claims, somewhat. They never attempted to look for Danny's father's car again, which he now claimed his father had buried under gravel somewhere.
As a part of their investigation, the RCMP had Danny meet with a forensic psychiatrist to discuss his memories. It was determined by the expert that Danny had never actually experienced what he claimed to, and was instead suffering from a condition called false memory syndrome. Eventually, the RCMP agrees with the psychiatrist, and even though Danny lodges complaints about the way he was treated and the way his statements were investigated, nothing comes of his account from that night. Danny even launches a Facebook campaign in 2014. He raises over $10,000 to pay for a private company to dig up his father's car. He wants it tested for DNA evidence. Unfortunately, the few rusted car parts that are recovered provide nothing of value to the case. But in May of 2016, Newfoundland authorities announced that due to advances in DNA technology, there was a new breakthrough in the case. As of this recording, that was almost 10 years ago. And that so-called breakthrough was never discussed again.
The RCMP have faced their fair share of criticism for their work on this case. They were accused of bullying David Summerton into a confession. Danny Tuff remains outraged that they didn't want to dig up his father's car. But Dana's mother, Dawn, and her now husband, Jeff, have publicly stated that they have faith in the police. The fact that the case remains open to this day is enough for them to trust investigators are still determined to find out what happened to Dana and are putting every effort into their investigation.
And so 45 years after her disappearance, we are still left wondering who exactly kidnapped and murdered 14-year-old Dana Bradley. All we know for sure is that on Monday, December 14th, 1981, Dana made phone calls trying to get a ride home. Then she set out from her friend Penny's house towards the bus stop on Topsail Road. Maybe Dana was shivering in the December chill, or maybe she was just feeling too lazy to wait for the bus. But she definitely wanted to get back home for her mom's birthday dinner as fast as possible. So, like she'd done so many times before, Dana stuck out her thumb, believing that a kind and friendly stranger would get her home safe.
If you have any information about Dana Bradley's case, you can call the Newfoundland and Labrador Provinces tip line at 1-800-222-TIPS, or you can visit www.nlcrimestoppers.com.
Thank you for listening to The Final Hours. If you have any other information about Dana Bradley's case, please share it with us on social media. We want to hear from you. Your thoughts, condolences, and feedback are what make this community so special.
At Crime House, we value your support. Share your thoughts on social media and remember to rate, review, and follow The Final Hours to help others discover the show.
And to enhance your listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode of The Final Hours ad-free, along with early access and exciting bonus content.
The Final Hours is hosted by Sarah Turney and me, Courtney Nicole, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by The Final Hours team: Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benadon, Lori Marinelli, Natalie Pritzofsky, Sarah Camp, Ellie Reed, Andrew Rosenblum, and Russell Nash. Thank you for listening.